interpreting than Socrates, in a more rational way than Socrates actually was.
Of course, yes, right. I think Socrates was more fresh in his perception because he was representing that first shift. He was there representing the spirit of free inquiry. Yeah? So he could go in any direction, ask any question and find out what it was. He wasn't making any dogmas yet, any rational dogmas, which for Plato and Aristotle later became a must, a ground, a foundation. But for him, that wasn't foundation yet. So he wasn't purely rational. He was still inquiring into rationality. And that's the beauty of it, because he could allow himself to go in any direction. Though he preferred to go into the rational direction. So, from there we can start with Aristotle. I have something to say that actually I need two at least more sessions, yes, to finish the course. But we can also finish it in a very fast way with all the major concepts in linguistics and then have something like interactive action if you want. Because it won't be something very, very necessary for you unless you really want to study linguistics, and then we have to dedicate more time for every of those topics. I have to spend at least 2-3 sessions on Saussure alone. Yes, we have to go through all his lectures, all his course on linguistics. Then we have to look into other things. Chomsky, it's another giant, you know, at least 2 lectures. Doesn't make sense really to stretch it over 2.
Yeah. So what you can do is,
if there is an interest really to go into linguistic studies, it's an introduction. Yeah. I will cover major things, what they say, without really going very deep into it, and then we see. So I am not sure yet what to do. Mm-hmm. Shall we start today and see? Because we are really kind of...
Yeah, but you can't just wind it up when you've got things that you haven't addressed.
Yes.
It becomes an incomplete thought.
Yes, but well, still we are kind of... it's an introductory course. I have an excuse that I have to cover major issues in linguistics. So, and since I did it quite intensely in the Vedic and Vedantic paradigm and Bhartrihari and Tantra. We spent several sessions on Tantra. So I think those topics come naturally into this Western view, yeah, Western thought. And we will see how they differ and why. And we started already with differences in alphabets. We have 2 different traditions, not only linguistically but also philosophically. We have Hebrew alphabet, which became the basis for all alphabets in the West and was taken by Greeks. Was invented in such a way that letters made another presentation of our speech, and the source or the origin of language was hidden, veiled. Suddenly Greeks didn't have any access to it. It was mysterious to them. They thought about it in most mysterious terms, and the period of rationality starts from there. And I connect it with this shift in language, yes? Because this is obviously a related topic. So as we can see that Aristotle, who came after Socrates, completely already uses him and his rational perception of things. as the ground for his thinking. He has defined the concept of logos in terms of the phonetic phenomenon of speech as an expression of the individual soul. Now here it must be said that for Aristotle, individual soul does not mean soul in Vedantic sense. It means an intelligent being, body. The soul means this mental being with the body together. And that is the major distinction. But his explanation is quite wonderful. We can read his quotation. Now, what takes place in the making of vocal sounds is a show of what there is in the soul, in the way of passions. And what is written is a show of the vocal sounds. That's quite obvious, yes? What is written is representing that show which is representing those passions. And just as writing is not the same among all men, so also the vocal sounds are not the same. On the other hand, those things of which these sounds and writings are a show, in the first place, are among all men the same passions of the soul. And the matters of which these, the passions, give likening representations are also the same. Well, here we can argue, and we will see what Humboldt will say on this, that actually every language represents something very special and very unique to that particular nation. It has an inner form and represents nation in a different way. That's why we cannot translate directly terms, because though passions are the same, or similar rather, they are not really the same. They are defined by different linguistic context. So when Aristotle uses the word soul, I just said, he means something else, not Vedantic soul, not that living being beyond body. And in his treatise on the soul, you can clearly see his definition as a mental being, rational, intelligent being. Here we can clearly see the definition of logos as represented by sounds and letters, where the words, though they are differently expressed in different languages, are still signifying the same psychophysical reality of the being. This meaning will dominate the vast Western thinking and all other approaches to the semantics. We will see it all the time. We are born out of this meaning. We think the same as Aristotle. We think that we have the same passions, the same meanings, only we express them differently. We believe deeply in this. It's the ground or the foundation of all Western rationality. And this is was the real basis of logocentrism, yes, in Derrida's terms. All what I say is what I am, and it is what it is. We believe somewhere that it is like that. Take my word for it. I'm just taking something from English. Take my word for it. That means I'm telling you something which makes sense to me. It is kind of difficult to distinguish what logocentrism is and why Derrida was so taken by it, and this new concept came up through this phenomenology and post-structuralism in Europe. Logocentrism is based on the belief that the word spoken by man is the testimony of his being. It is the truth, as it was always accepted in the Western courts and by the Holy Inquisition. In the courts you have, even now in the West, that Bible is brought to you, you have to put your hand on the Bible and say, that's it. And then we believe you. Is it not funny? It's very funny, because all the lies were made in this particular way. That you believe me, that what I will lie to you will be the truth for you, and then I will win. But that's exactly the ground, the deeper foundation of logocentrism, believing in the word as a testimony of the truth. It has to be seen in that moment of time and context. It cannot represent truly any other reality. Therefore, the spoken word is truer than the written. And here, the reader dedicates a lot of thinking to this. Yeah? So it's the whole philosophical tradition speaks that the written word does not represent the spoken word, cannot represent it. It's something which is out of context, it can be put into any other context, and therefore it lost its own validity in that particular time of expression. And there is truth in it, but it's not the whole truth. So, such a view on the nature of language and our intelligent being became dominant all over the world as we know it. It is this understanding that led the Western thought to a complete identification of the signifier with the signified and ended in the lap of I think, therefore I exist. Though it has deeper meaning, this I think, therefore I exist, and as I found out it from our friend Rudy, and that was an experience which Descartes had, yes? When he closed his eyes and he was in a dangerous moment of his time, and suddenly he saw thoughts. And then he thought, wow, and I think that means I still exist, I didn't die. Yeah? From that, this meaning came into being, but of course it means completely different thing after him saying it. The mind is believed to be able to discover the truth of our existence, even if it does it in its own way, and in its own mental reality, different from that which is to be signified by it, phenomenology's concept. It still corresponds with what it signifies in the intelligent being of Aristotle or Socrates. So I want, with this kind of preamble, I want to plunge into the Western linguistics with this ground, because this is the real ground for their thinking. I'm not going to repeat myself what we said before, so it means all these things that discovery of Sanskrit language in 19th century was the beginning of all those subjects of humanities. Yes? Linguistics itself was born out of it. So Humboldt was one of the first who got inspired by the studies of Sanskrit language and culture in general. He even could converse in Sanskrit as we know it. It was recorded. And he, with his students and colleagues, and he recited from the Gita by heart. So, what was the most surprising for this, for Humboldt and others, other scholars, that the language can be built in a systematic way. So, language itself becomes a source of enlightenment for the mental being. Because if we know how language functions, mind can do something with that. If we do not know what language represents, mind is half-blind. So the central concept of the development of higher mental capacities in man through the enlightened studies of language was first presented by Humboldt in his Introduction to Kavi Language of Java, which was later published as a separate essay on the diversity of the structure of human language and its influence on the intellectual development of mankind. And it's a profound introduction. It's one of the best of its kind, and I read it many times, in Russian of course, not in German, and every time I read it was an inspiration. It's an inspired speech. This work, according to Heidegger, has ever since determined the course of all subsequent philology and philosophy of language. Now, I will give you a few quotations, what he says and what he wants to say. According to Humboldt, articulated sound is the basis and essence of all speech. He speaks of language in this way. Properly conceived of, language is something persistent and in every instant transitory. Persistent and transitory at the same time. Even its maintenance by writing is only an incomplete, mummified preservation necessary if one is again to render perceptible the living speech concerned. In itself, language is not work, ergon, but an activity, energia. Its true definition may therefore only be genetic. So he nearly speaks as Abhinavagupta about Paravak. It is, after all, the continual intellectual effort to make the articulated sound capable of expressing thought. It is, after all, the continual intellectual effort to make the articulated sound capable of expressing thought. In a rigorous sense, this is the definition of speech in each given case. We are looking for better articulation of meaning and thought. Thought has to be shaped through the word and by the word. I even started to see myself when I think, that I think by word, and this word tells me what it wants to think. So my thought is being determined by the speech I perceive, I attend to, and my mind follows. And it happens all the time. You just observe what is happening within your mind. How do we think? Is it not the way how we think? And until that expression takes final shape, I do not know what I really think. My mind does not know. Well, I feel the presence of the meaning, but it is not yet fully shaped for my mind. So therefore my mind is in the darkness. What was that? And it wants to know. And then when the articulation takes shape, my mind says, ah, that's what it was. And it can hold on to it. And it can dwell on it and discover more things around it. That's how the word works. Essentially, however, only the totality of this speaking can be regarded as language. Now, these are the definitions of Humboldt. Humboldt conceives of language as a particular intellectual effort. Language as an intellectual effort, mental activity. Language must be regarded not as a dead product of the past, but as a living creation. It must be abstracted from all that it affects, as a designation of the comprehended ideas. Furthermore, we must revert to a more meticulous examination of its origins and its interaction with intellectual activity. We must revert to a more thorough examination of its origins and its interaction with intellectual activity. So he separates intellectual activity from the action of the word. These are two complementary processes. Humboldt speaks of an inner form of language, which we mentioned several times in our course, which is difficult to define in the conceptual terms. He says, if in the soul the feeling truly arises that language is not merely a medium of exchange for mutual understanding, but a true world which the intellect must set between itself and objects by the inner labor of its power, then the soul is on the true way toward discovering constantly more in language and putting constantly more into it. This is very important quotation. I underlined it. Shall we try again to see? If in the soul the feeling truly arises that language is not merely a medium of exchange for mutual understanding, but a true world, world in itself. The word has a true world, with its own true world, which the intellect must set between itself and objects of the inner labor of its power, then the soul is on the true way towards discovering constantly more in language and putting constantly more into it. So what I see here is something very unique. So language is not simply a conventional means of exchange for mutual understanding only, yes, but a true world, world as such, of all the meanings and all the contexts which are created in this manifestation. And it has to be manifested in one way or another. We live in this in linguistic space, linguistic reality. We see the world as such because of that reality. We, the intellect, must set this world, intellect must set it between itself and objects by the inner labor of its power. Now, it's complicated. Yeah? The intellect must set this true world of language between itself and the objects which it examines by the inner labor of its power. Then the soul is on the true way towards discovering constantly more in language and putting constantly more into it. The soul, there is one more category, which is on the way, on the true way towards discovering constantly more in language. You can see all these categories. You see the mind, you see the language which mind sets between itself and the objective reality, and you see the soul acting through this device, learning more and more from this language about the world and how to act in the world, and introducing more and more categories in a subtle way into that language, changing the world. It's a beautiful image. It's a fundamental, final kind of accord of Humboldt. Actually, Humboldt is remembered as the inspirer and idealist none could actually follow afterwards. He was unbeatable. Nobody could really follow all his inspirations. Everybody refers to him, but nobody really developed anything on his ground. Nevertheless, his inspirations did generate the whole direction of new approach to thinking in these matters, in the fields of linguistics and the philosophy of language. Now, we are moving into another kind of giant, Nietzsche. Nietzsche was interesting. I skip so many, I can't really speak of every one of them on the way, yes? Yeah, there is no way to really do that. But so few of them were, must be mentioned. Nietzsche, according to the reader, contributed a great deal to the liberation of the signifier from its dependence or derivation with respect to the logos and the related concept of truth or the primary signified. Now, here is something very unique in a way. What for the reader looks that he saw that suddenly logocentrism is based on complete identification of the signifier with signified and dependence of the signifier on the signified. He wants to liberate signifier as it was liberated in Indian tradition. Signifier was never dependent on the signified. Yeah? Rather opposite. Signified was dependent on the signifier. Signifier was creator, was creating the word, the meaning, and that meaning was taking shape in manifestation. So already in 1873, Nietzsche described metaphor as an image which the intellect presents as truth. And here it's also very interesting psychological observation how mind works. Look at this. The intellect, as a means for the preservation of the individual, develops its chief power in dissimulation. A nerve stimulus first transcribes into an image, first metaphor. The image again copied into a sound, second metaphor. And each time he, the creator of language, leaps completely out of one sphere, right into the midst of entirely different one. That impulse towards the formation of metaphors, that fundamental impulse of man which we cannot reason away for one moment, for thereby we should reason away man himself, is will to power. The so-called drive for knowledge can be traced back to a drive to appropriate and conquer. In our thought, the essential feature is fitting new material into old schemes, making equal what is new. Now, I made out of long texts small quotation. You can see how I cut it into pieces. It's all from Nietzsche what I put into my course. But it is the most essential. What he says here, it's all his concept. It's his vision. He suddenly saw, he had an experience. He had an experience how we translate reality into the linguistic reality. Yes? And that's what he describes. The intellect as a means for the preservation of the individual, he has his own understanding of intellect, preservation of the individual, a memory, who we are and what we are here to do. I remember who I am and I know all things as I know them already. So whatever I will perceive new, I will translate into my old language. Otherwise, I will not take it. I will lose myself and I will lose that what I perceive. Develops his chief power by dissimulation. What is dissimulation, Amy?
Something like lying.
Yes.
Pretending.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a show of some kind, yeah? I have to make to myself a show to believe that I am real and I am dealing with the reality. So a nerve stimulus first transcribed into an image. So I perceive the image or the impression or perception. First metaphor, I made an image which I want to take. The image again copied into a sound. I copy it into language. I find it in my linguistic space, a token, an equivalent, what it is. What is this image of, this is the tree, I know what it is. So I have two metaphors. First, an impression, second metaphor, I found for this image, another impression in the sound, in the language, second metaphor. And each time he, the creator of language, leaps completely out of one sphere right into the midst of the entirely different one. There's somebody within who leaps out to perceive that as first and second metaphor, the creator of language. Look at this beautiful experience.
Would you say that, because I understand that all language is metaphor, going along this prescription.
But look what he does. He left metaphors there, and then he suddenly says, each time he, and that is, he speaks about the creator man, the creator of language, leaps completely out of one sphere right into the midst of the entirely different one. So he comes from the inner reality to the outer reality, and every time these metaphors take place, this is a kind of a feedback to this leaping out from within to without. They don't stop. But that's all right. Let them be. If we see what they are, if we understand what they do. Yeah? That impulse towards the formation of metaphors, that fundamental impulse of man, which we cannot reason away for one moment, for thereby we should reason away man himself. This is what man does all the time. What he does, he conquers with his leaping out, the outer reality. And the process of conquering, this process of metaphoring, getting back metaphors to himself and assimilating it, assimilating the outer world to which he is leaping out in terms of metaphors, linguistic reality. This is that language which Humboldt puts between intellect and the world of objects, which soul has to enlarge. You see, this is another image. So this view is somewhat close to the mystic statement of Humboldt, as we just saw it, which never was totally understood and assimilated by the Western linguistic tradition, but it was deeply understood by phenomenology. And all phenomenology is based on this perception. It reflects something of the psychological truth of being beyond words. Nietzsche introduces here two fundamental perceptions of linguistic reality being different from the objective. In other words, the reality of the signified is different from the reality of the signifier, and the drive behind the reality of the signifier is a will to power, or drive for knowledge. And this is exactly Ichha of Abhinavagupta, the will to know, and the will to possess, to know oneself as such or as different. These two fundamental concepts inspired the reader to review and to develop the concept of saussure and sign into the concept of difference, the trace structure of the sign. We will come to the reader briefly at the end. It is in this particular view that the influence of Indian thought can be traced back and brought forward for further investigations. The time of structuralism and post-structuralism was trying to deal with the concept of sign as it was seen and developed by Saussure. Now we are coming to another giant who became a giant, who was never seen in his time as a giant. He was just a professor of linguistics and... That's, yes, there is no difference if we are there, yeah? If we are everywhere. But there is a difference. If we make no difference before we really realize no difference, then it becomes logocentric. Logocentric in pure sense. We believe that what we say is what it is. And it is in a way so, only from the highest perception, not from the middle and the lower. It's a strange thing.
And that's the meaning of that word, difference, an embedded word.
Yes.
Which means that you can be conscious,
yes,
of all the levels of perception and interpretation and metaphor as being different, and at the same time the same.
Right. We will come to the reader, and this is some great thought about it. That's, you can have a consciousness which is always sliding, so to say, which is never static in this perception of trace structure, which is always moving and always never fixed finally. But at the same time, there is a consciousness which is, so to say, holding on to itself in this constant sliding, as if it is static. So it can perceive the difference.
Otherwise known as reality.
Yes. As that referred to as reality.
No, this is reality.
Referred to because he doesn't want to make any reference in pure linguistic sense anymore, so he crosses it out, saying that I am saying, but I am not saying. I'm just saying that without saying with the word, if you can perceive that. So it's an interesting view. It's kind of a glimpse of some kind of experience in the mind, in the deeper mind. So Saussure is considered to be a father of general linguistics and structuralism in the West. Actually, his lectures on linguistics are only a few pages, you know. It's a very small thing. It's a conspect of those lectures. He himself didn't want to publish it. He was never sure till the end that it is completely right. But his students, after his death, published those lectures, and it became another world for the West. So he was a Sanskrit scholar and professor of Sanskrit language, which is not mentioned anymore, because it's not good to mention that. More than 20 years, yes? And his dissertation, his PhD, was on, those who know Sanskrit, genitivus absolutus. It's one of the most difficult syntactic construction in Sanskrit, genitivus absolutus. So he knew Sanskrit very well. So he says, I propose to retain the word sign to designate the whole and to replace concept of sound image respectively by signified and signifier, replacing the use of the words concept and sound image, which was used before. So he proposes one sign which combines both. This proposition is clearly reflecting or even translating the same concept of vāca and vācaka of Bhartrihārī's definition of spota, something which is to be spoken or signified, and that's something which is signifying that. These are two sides of one side. The sound image is what is heard, not the sound heard, but the being heard of the sound. That's what Saussure says. Being heard is structurally phenomenal and belongs to an order radically dissimilar to that of the real sound in the world. Now, you remember our distinction between prakrita dvani and dvani, vaikrita dvani. This is exactly the definition of Bhartrihārī. We are hearing not the real sound, we are hearing the impression, the articulation of the sound. We are paying attention to the articulation and not to the sound as such.
That's the meaning, isn't it?
No, it's just articulation, spota. It's not yet the meaning. We are recreating, yes. No, he says being heard of the sound. It's first level. Then it will come to that what the meaning is. And meaning he is not identifying with this. For him, signified is not meaningful in pure meaningful sense as a semantic. He takes it somewhere else. We will see what he does. This distinction was clearly defined by Bhattacharya as Vaikrita and Prakrita Dhavani, which we already saw, and by other grammarians of Indian linguistic tradition, as it was spoken by Abhinava Gupta. The very concept of spota is based on it. What we actually hear is the articulation of the sound, Prakrita Dhvani, rather than the sound itself, Vaikrita. Sound is only triggering in us this inner hearing articulation. That's how we can communicate. We have to know the same language, yes? Otherwise we can't communicate. So, Saussure continues in the Bhartrihari's manner. The latter, the sound image, is not the material sound, a purely physical thing, but the psychic imprint of the sound, the impression that it makes on our senses. The sound image is sensory, and if I happen to call it material, it is only in that sense, and by way of opposing it to the other term of the association, the concept, which is generally more abstract. It is this other component, as opposed to the psychic imprint, the association, the concept, that Saussure will call the signified, and the first component, the signifier, exactly as in Bhartrihari. I want to come to Saussure proper, to his own things. Examining the notion of value in his lectures in June 1911, he had three courses, 3 years, yes? 11, 12, and 13, and then he passed away. Three times he had his course on linguistics. Saussure introduced the distinction between the word and the term based on the distinction between associative and syntagmatic relations. And I will come to it now. It's a simple thing. Outside and inside speech, respectively. It's an interesting, it's a double relation. On the associative level, the word is something like a flexional paradigm. Dominus, domini, dominum. It has its own linguistic reality, relates to its own etymological and sound related matters. Yes? Linguistic reality. The word is taken from the language, it is cognized that it is taken from that language, and it has certain relations through the sound with other members of language. These are all connected in a certain way in virtue of that fact. Or we may compare animus, anima, animal, and so on, which reflect a different order of relations in this associative family. Now, he calls that associative family. Associative by the sound, by the roots. He doesn't see etymological meaning in systematic way. He thought about it as associative. On the syntagmatic level, words are subjects to a kind of relation that is independent of the first associative and based on their linkage to other terms. Language itself represents a system in which all the terms appear as linked by relations. Language is nothing but this syntax, a web of all possible grammatical relations among the units. Now, to explain it, I have to read a few more quotations and you will clearly see the difference between associative and syntagmatic relations. Where there are terms, there are also values. The idea of value is tacitly implied in that of term. Always hard to keep these two ideas apart. Value is synonymous with sense, meaning. The value is an element of the sense. I will come back to it. All the units of language have their inherent value, which is a part of perception and sensation. which means it belongs to the life and experience of the individual. It can be felt as such and known as such by other means than the word, though it is triggered by the word. And Saussure explains, he's going one step deeper, abstracting the value of this sense experience from the sense itself. It is perhaps one of the most subtle points there is in linguistics, to see how sense depends on, but nevertheless remains distinct from value. Here he will introduce what the meaning is. Meaning for him is not signified. It belongs to the value, which is different from that which is signified by the concept. On this, the linguist's view and the simplistic view that sees the language as nomenclatura differs strikingly. I will give you one example which will explain this associative and syntagmatic in very direct and immediate, it's his example. The difficulties of semantics is that, as Saussure put it, the meaning as counterpart of the image and the meaning as a counterpart of coexisting terms merge. And this is the problem of the signified. So he compares it with the coin of 20 francs. It is exchangeable with the bread and it is comparable with other coins. It has two value system coexisting. The same is associative, is with the coins, and syntagmatic is with the bread. Makes sense? It's very simple, no? The word speaks about reality. It speaks about its own reality. It has its own association within the language. And it also speaks about the reality which it wants to link with, or influence, or point, or communicate about. So this 20 francs is exchangeable with bread in one system of meaning, or comparable with money, with other coins, in another system of meaning. The difficulty of semantics is that the meaning as a counterpart of the image and the meaning as a counterpart of coexisting terms merge. Now we think that what we say is the reality itself, though it isn't. It's only a signified. It's not a real thing. So he takes out of this his sense of meaning. And sense of meaning goes somewhere else. And we will see where it goes. You can never find the meaning of a word, he says, by considering only the exchangeable item. But you have to compare the similar series of comparable words. You cannot take words in isolation either. They are in the system of language. This is how the system to which the term belongs is one of the sources of value. The value of a word can never be determined except by the contribution of coexisting terms which delimit it, or, to insist on the paradox already mentioned, what is in the word is only ever determined by the contribution of what exists around it. What is in the word is the value, around it syntagmatically or around it associatively.
What do you suppose he means by value?
Yes, and here we come. This is a last quotation, what he means by value, and it will explain how the semantic shifted from linguistics altogether. Semantics was taken later as a separate discipline from linguistics because of his definition of value as semantic, as meaning. The values are also relative and are the product of the sign. The signified element alone is nothing. It blurs into a shapeless mass. Likewise, the signifying element also. In itself is nothing. Neither of these. It's actually, the Derrida's later definition is very beautiful of signified and signifier. He says that signified is never there, and the signifier is never that. These two, never that and never there thing, determine something which is there and which is that.
So the idea of value is the idea of difference. It's not a positive and negative, it's just a distinction between.
Right.
Is that true?
Yes. That's yes.
One thing is distinguished from another.
Yes.
And it's that difference which gives it its meaning.
Yes. It's in the mind, it's that. Yes, right.
Question, if this is about, my wondering has always been, when we say, for example, the word mother, we know a mother gives birth to a child, but if you say something about my mother or your mother, it has totally different history for each person.
Right.
So their mother maybe died.
Right.
Or their mother was wonderful.
Right.
So when we use that word...
Now you're introducing value system into it, yeah? You make it alive. You make that mother in the linguistic setting and mother in the general meaning outside how it is used. You charge it with that value, which is meaning for you, and which is meaning for everyone different. But we use the same system. The same 20 friends, topics are exchanging as bread, but for everybody bread tastes different and means different. That's what he wants to say. Yes, it is that difference, that thing in itself, which has to be determined by this device of language. What would have to be the case in order to have this relation between signified and signifying elements given in itself? It would above all be necessary that the idea should be determinate in advance, and it is not. So the idea of what mother is or what bread is not determined in advance.
And what is the 20 friends itself?
Yes, we can come to that. What is 20 friends itself? It's a symbol. Symbol, and it is also reality. It's a good question. It would above all be necessary that signified element should be something determined in advance, and it is not. That is why the relation is only another expression of values in contrast in the system. That is true on any linguistic level. So this scheme of the signified signifier is not the starting or original point in the language. It appeared from the values we wanted to put into them. It's very close to what Humboldt saw, yes, as a soul contributing to the mind using the language which set that language in between intellect and the world. And the soul can contribute to that language and learn from it about the world. So it's very close to that. The value system comes from somewhere else. It's very close to even Aristotelian vision of passions of the soul being expressed in the word. So to sum up, Saussure says, it's not an original. This is what we have to understand. It is constructed. That's why it's a structuralism. It's a structure which gives us an idea what structuralism is about. So to sum up, he says, the word does not exist without a signified as well as a signifying element. But the signified element is only a summary of the linguistic value, presupposing the mutual interaction of terms in each language system. What Saussure ended up with was nothing less than a conclusion that actually nothing can be truly known in the field of language, that there are no universal categories by which one can know things as they are. This is what logocentrism is representing. Every language develops its own categories and values in accordance with the ways of living and the data it has syntagmatically and associatively available for its creation. For if the relation of the signified and the signifier is not original but arbitrary, then any signifier can, if necessary, if it is agreed upon, denote any signified. What he actually did, he removed the meaning and the sound from the science of language. So after sociolinguistics had to deal neither with meaning nor with sound, but with the naked structures, morphology and syntax, in a diachronic and synchronic ways. There are two ways to deal with language: historically, seeing how it is developed, and statically, as such. As if every sample was the original one and nothing more. The idea of systematic approach to etymology was out of question altogether. There was only association of the words. There was no etymology in systematic way. Saussure did not see any other meaning in the sound content of phoneme other than of differentiating significance, delegating the problem of meaning to the social conventions and thus to the social psychology, mentioning that the science of the future, as semiology, official linguistic will be a part, will appear in the future. And he was right, because it was exactly as he said. It is possible to conceive of a science which studies the role of science as part of social life. It would form part of social psychology, and hence a general psychology. We shall call it semiology, from the Greek semion, sign. It would investigate the nature of science and the laws governing them. Since it does not yet exist, and it was at the beginning of the century, one cannot say for certain that it will exist. But it has a right to exist, a place ready for it in advance. Linguistics is only one branch of this general science. Linguistics is only one branch of this general science. The laws which semiology will discover will be laws applicable in linguistics, and linguistics will thus be assigned to a clearly defined place in the field of human knowledge. And that's exactly how it happened. Now, what happened was interesting, because this semiotics could not really free itself fully from that structure, which was, because sign itself is a structure, that semantics itself was stuck to this structure. And we could see it clearly later what happened. So we lost that track of systematic view and meaningful sound and meaningful word as such. It does not exist. It's only a structure to bring some values and some difference into mental perception. So what happened after Saussure in the science of semiology, or as it is sometimes called, semiotics? We can see into that. Semiotics as a science of meaning. Semiotics has three branches: semantics, syntactics, and pragmatics. The relation between science and the things they refer to, their denotata, is the semantics field. Science and denotata. Syntactics, relations of science to each other in formal structures. I'm just quoting it from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Pragmatics, relation of science to their impacts on those who use them, also known as general semantics. Can you see three levels? It's quite interesting to see that, once at least. We have a subjective, we have an objective, and we have some interactive. We can clearly see that there is no other definition of semantics than that of the relations of signs in their denotata. In the social or linguistic context, it depends where we move. The idea that the sound itself may have a meaning in its own system of meanings, that the word, the signifier, has its own reality independent from the signified, is completely banished from the science. There's no such possibility to go back. If I speak this way, I am immediately banished from the science, from linguistics. So what? When my professor read my article somewhere written on that Sanskrit introduces the system of etymons, she said to my friend, close friend, "You see, we were teaching him, and everything is for nothing." He just comes back to his own, you know, ignorance. He believes that the sound can have a meaning, can have a significance. Yes, I know.
But this also motivated in what used to be philology. A very concerted effort to use language so consciously and so deliberately that meaning becomes the main focus of the word. And so there is a post-structural movement in philosophy that wants to restore meaning to the word itself, to the way the word, to the word's use, to use the word to create meaning. And when you do that, then you realize that you get back to a level of sound and origin, and you restore the whole essence of language by being more careful about your usages and your meanings.
This is the Heideggerian wish.
Heidegger and Derrida have carried that,
yes,
intention.
Wish to recover that ultimate signified, or that original name, yes? That original name, because signified is not something else than that name. In conceptual sense, as we see, signified is not real reality. Yeah? It is reality in consciousness. Reality as perceived by consciousness. It's not being without consciousness. So now we are always kind of associating them.
I'm thinking of sign language, where there is no sound, but there are gestures, meanings, communication.
Right. Well,
here.
It goes through the word the same, yeah? They speak words. They don't speak anything else. We can show words, we can write them, we can speak them, and so on and so forth. But these will be also the same things.
What I think is that the creativity of consciousness is the ability to create meaning which has its origin in beings. But this is a poetic enterprise, and so there is a level at which poetry and philosophy use language to create truth. And this is a correspondence, but it's more than a correspondence between speech and what is being signified. It is a resonance which language creates that reveals the thing itself. So that's a special mission or project of a branch of philosophy and poetry. So there are a few gifted creators who have discovered that it's possible to do that. So then you have to think that that's originally what language was anyway.
Here there are more questions than answers. Because when I think about I can really relate to Sanskrit language. Yes? I can see how systematically it comes down, creates families of words, how they are all interlinked and related through the sound structure, through the sound vibration, yes? Colors. All these colors paint the same, they are not mixed yet. Now when we come to other already developed, conceptually developed languages, There is a puzzle for me. I do not know what to say. I really can't understand. That language must be recreated in colors by the poet who has intuition, high intuition, to see the original colors of those sounds and paint with them consciously, choosing those words, coining them, making them. But he has to have initiation into some other perception. I'm not sure it's possible to do with our ordinary languages anymore. You have to be a poet of the highest kind.
You mean the computer can't do it for you?
Well, it requires us to be fully aware in the moment of creating the word that the power of it as we want it to be represented should be there in the word. Now, that ability, I'm not sure we have.
Some people have it.
Well, Sri Aurobindo
have
it, and we haven't seen too many other people
who
have
it. That's why I'm pointing to this particular line of development in philosophy and poetry in the 20th century, where it's evident that from a position of creative speech and intuitive consciousness, a language is created.
Right.
And it's not enough just to have the intuition, but also the creative energy, the power, through multiple texts. And Sri Aurobindo is the best example, but Heidegger and Derrida and other poetic writers are also there, where for years and years on end, this language faculty is used to bring into powerful form through language contact with the being of what is being spoken. So it's an art.
Yeah.
Some have it. Some have that contact. But it's a laborious process.
Right.
It's also interesting when Sri Aurobindo speaks, for example, about a certain line of savagery, then one word is in a different way, then it's no more Obermann, but it's higher man, and the same words are there, but
it's
just how the
risen determines the. Yes. No, it's exactly that what Humboldt was saying, that the intellect has to use language as a world, yeah? World, real world, putting, setting it in between itself and the objective world. And soul, our soul, if it takes it, it can learn from that language how to deal with reality in itself and can introduce more things into it, illuminate more and more with other contents, new ones, more intuitive, and thus kind of create the world, manifest something from within. So, if we see the similar picture, Abhinava Gupta and all that Vedic tradition with our Western linguistics, if we see similarity, that would be a very good point to end our course with, to see the similarity of two traditions. That they are trying to reach to the same meaning from different ways, by different methodologies. One is more rational, other is more religious and more mythological. But they're speaking about the same phenomena. Or maybe not phenomenon, maybe something more than that. All right, I think our time is up. Yes? So shall we end with a minute of silence?